whole couch. Three troublemakers in a row. I'll keep an eye on you guys. All right, so we're on the spiritual maxims. I'm again in one of my odd moods. I don't know what that's
what
about.
What page is this maxim?
40. Page 40.
That should be at the end of the book.
Yeah.
There, page 40.
Yeah.
And we're on the second maxim, I think, right? We only did one, right?
Yeah. She
puts words in my mouth.
All right, so we're on the second one. And let's have a talk real quick. There's a lot of these maxims. They go on for a while. We could probably do another month in this book.
Yeah.
Do you want to keep doing that? Or do you want to just kind of summarize the maxims and start next week with St. Teresa of Avila?
I mean, the maxims are his own words, right?
They all are. Oh, yes. Well, the letters were his words. But yeah, the maxims are his also. He wrote this also. It's a separate publication, actually. So
I leave it to you to decide for me. Have you started recording?
Yes. Yes, my apologies for those listening to the recording. You've got a minute and 20 seconds of nothing so far. All right.
I want to know what's in his coffee.
Actually, if I wasted 60 years of life, 1 minute and 20 seconds.
Very good.
That, wow.
Okay, that's good.
All
sorry,
right.
Sorry.
It's
not
okay.
Yet 60.
Almost.
Almost, huh? Oof, I'm not yet 60 either. When we enter upon spiritual life, we ought to consider thoroughly what we are, probing to the very depth. Okay, I love this sentence, because this is absolutely true. When we do that Vedic Christianity thing, that's where we start. You have to go to the very beginning. And he says, what you have to know, consider thoroughly what you are. So, Gita, what are you?
I'm a soul.
Very good.
Body, yeah.
All right. So your spirit.
Yeah.
That's the primary thing about that. And then your nature is?
Yeah, I'm blissful.
Blissful?
Loveful.
Love.
Peaceful.
Peaceful. You exist?
Yeah.
I didn't know if you know that. You exist.
All pervading.
All pervading. And intend intelligent, right?
Yeah.
And intelligent.
She's been reading her books. I don't think she's been doing any content.
Just see.
She's
not good for me, Swamiji.
Now, Swamiji warns us about that. Yeah, so it's important to know, because it's your identity that's causing all of your trouble. So we can say, oh, I'm spirit, I'm intelligent, I'm blissful, and I exist. We can hold on to those, but we still believe that I exist because I have a body, which isn't the truth. And we also believe I'm intelligent because I have a mind, which is also not the truth, you know, and we believe that we're, you know, bliss when we're in a good mood, which isn't the truth either. So it's very important to put our eye on the fact that we are transcendent. We're not limited by a body. And for us, it's very much make-believe. It is. But I always come back to that point. This room was make-believe, not more than a decade or so ago. You know, we would have been sitting in the woods right here. So somebody imagined this room and then manifested it. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what we do. We imagine that we know our nature. We imagine that we have an understanding of what we are. And in some time, for him it was 9 years, his imagination manifests. The mind is the portal to this world. It's how things come into this world, you know, through mind.
I like this idea from provisional faith. Sometimes faith to some people, is a negative word. It means, you know, believing in something that you can't prove. But what happens spiritually, to know something that's true, you have to experience it. But if you haven't experienced it yet, then you have to believe there's a possibility. And then as people start experiencing things, then they know, but then they can't prove it to anybody else.
Yeah, I don't personally, and this is just a personal thing, I don't believe in that faith. I don't think that is an accurate definition of faith. You know, faith is that, it's that internal knowing, or that that hunch that we have that we're something more, that life has a meaning, that there's a point to all of this, that that I'm eternal. We sort of have a sense of that, because we can't imagine our death. Swami Prabhudananda gave that little bit to me once. You know, we were sitting around the table, and I had read about Ramana Maharshi's enlightenment experience, about when he was a teenager, he lay down and just imagined being dead. And I tried it. It hasn't worked yet, but I tried it, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't imagine being dead. I didn't know what to imagine. What do you imagine if you're being dead? And so I told Swami Prabhudananda, I said, I can't really imagine it. And he smiled. He said, yes, that too is a clue. You know, I said, what do you mean that too is a clue? So you can't imagine something you've never experienced. You know, you can't imagine you've never died. The same reason you can't imagine your birth. You know, you can't imagine not existing.
When you shift that perspective, when you're not the body, and then you can imagine the body and the mind being absent.
Mm. Yes.
But as long as you think that you're the body, it's very difficult to actually imagine. Because you can imagine the body being inert, being not receiving sensation. But you can't be the body and imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just my thought.
Yeah, you can. I had this very interesting... it was interesting and disturbing at the same time. I was laying in bed, just this is brand new stuff for me, like 3 nights ago. And I was sitting there, laying there, thinking about my life and my troubles and my character and my struggles. And I realized that when we think, we're talking to ourselves. There's a talker and a listener. And the talker is the mind. Who's the listener?
The soul.
God. That's a big clue. Watch yourself think. Because the problem is that when we think, we identify ourselves with the chatter, with the person who's talking. And we get the understanding and the comprehension from the God side, from the presence of the beloved in us. He's the one that gives everything meaning. So he sits there, literally, he is there as the silent witness within you, that you are talking to all the time with your mind. That's why the scriptures say that God is closer to you than the anklet on an ant, or so you can hear an anklet on an ant, you know, or closer, as the Upanishads say, he's closer to you than your neck. Such a bizarre way of saying that. I like it. But that's why God is the half of you that you talk to in your mind all the time. That is your nature. That I think, is the unchanging self. You know, and the chatterer is just the noise of the mind, the noise of the body feeding its information to the mind. And that's what we identify with. So we're the talker, we're the mover and the shaker, you know, the one that always gets the attention. But God is the silent and extremely patient, extremely tolerant, because the things he's had to listen to, you know, at least in my life, I'm not sure I'd want to be listening to them myself, you know. And so it's a wonderful clue. And I think faith is the hunch that we have about these things, because we've been experiencing them for our whole life. But we're not clear. We're so distracted and so unaware of the nature of our internal world that we don't know these things to be true because of that distraction and because of that inability to investigate them clearly because of the distraction. And so faith is that residue of knowing what we know without knowing why we know it. It's an intuitive...
It's in your subconscious, we bring by, you know, it's deep somewhere.
Yeah, it's...
But we try to make it, you know, come forward. I mean, we try to make it by thinking about it, then you reflect, introspection, then you say, it's a feeling, you know, sometimes you can't... You know.
Yeah, it's like when you've lost your cell phone, You know you have one. You just don't know where it is. You know, so you've got this intuitive feeling. Hey, have you ever gone out and started to get in the car and you're like, God, I just have this feeling that I forgot something. Usually I can't remember what it is and I go where I'm at. And when I get there, I realize, oh, God, I left my, I left that book on my desk. And so I've learned that if I've got that hunch, I don't go anywhere until it's solved, you know, about what that is. That's what faith is. Faith is that internal, intuitive knowing that you are part of an eternal relationship.
That's why they say that you must listen to your inner voice.
That's right. Yeah. Well, your inner voice, yeah.
We sometimes try to subdue it and, you know, try to... We should always believe in it because it's more true than we think it is.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Well, sometimes people get hints of things. My sister had the memory of living and dying before, and she believes that's true. She became interested in Eastern religions because of that.
Uh-huh.
I know some people who have had near-death experiences where they left the body for a while. One time I had a hint of myself, and I'm aware that I'm immensely old and I existed before my body was formed, but I don't remember my past. So people sometimes get hint of things.
Sure. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, religion has this reputation of being all pie in the sky, stuff you can't know, don't know. It's really the opposite of that. It's stuff that is blatantly obvious, but we have been so conditioned to living in it that we haven't conceived of most of it. Like that whole thing about thinking. I'm 55 years old. I've been living for 55 years and been interested in philosophy for 55 years. And it wasn't until three nights ago that I sat there and analyzed my own thinking and came to see, wow, it's a two-person job and there's only one person here. How is that happening?
What's a two-person job?
I didn't get it, sorry.
Thinking.
Thinking.
There's a talker and a listener. That doesn't make any sense. You're one person. If you know something, why do you have to say it and listen to it in order to think? You know, if you are the originator of the information and you know it, what is this whole process that's happening where it's being projected into a mind and observed by a witness?
Where would what you know be if you didn't think about it?
It'd be in the mind. Yeah,
that's
mind and senses.
That's what they say, witness consciousness.
Well, you are the witness. That's the subtle truth, everybody. So you are the part of your mind, part of the thinking process that's doing the listening. You're not the part that's doing the talking in your real nature. You see? And if the mind is still, who's remaining? Just the listener without the talker. So I think that's a pretty big and pretty concrete piece of information to explore. You know, at least I've been really pushing on it. It gets scary for me because things get a little shaky I get scared, actually. I get a little nervous because I feel like I could so easily become unhinged.
So can you repeat the last sentence for me?
I'm so afraid I could be unhinged.
Yeah.
That thinking is a two-person process, which isn't the case. We're one person. But all of your thoughts, you watch them, right? Do you not? They're presented to you. Mm-hmm. Is that not true? Like right now, if you sit there and sing the Star Spangled Banner or anything, I don't care. Just think, what's the experience? You're watching thought, are you not? That's how it happens, right? You can even hear it. You can even see it, some thoughts. It depends on the thought. But for that to happen, it has to be presented to you. You can't feel something that is you. You can't see something that is you. You know, you can't see your face. So this thinking is a two-part process, and it's something you can see very easily and understand and touch quite easily and experiment with even more easily, and it's part of the fundamental truth. You know, it shows you that demarcation. It shows you that part where you have split off from yourself. You've given power to an existence or to an idea of self that exists separate from you, and you've empowered that idea of yourself with your identity. By saying,
would you call that Maya?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Maya is necessary for that. Maya pretty much swirls into existence as that defines itself, you know? Because what do you do? Like, I ask you how you are. Who do you query? You don't query the listener. You don't query that silent part of you that's watching all of your thoughts and receiving all of this information. Who do you query? You query the noisy side. You query the body. Well, I'm feeling pretty good. I've got up early. I feel awake, you know? Or you query the mind. Well, I'm in a little bit of a bad mood. I feel a little lonely, blah, 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 blah. You see, when you query who you yourself, you see your delusion immediately. Because who do you query? You don't query the silent self, who's never changed. That part of you that's been watching your thoughts, listening to your thoughts, has never changed. It's always been fully attentive, fully present, fully accepting. It's heard everything. It's the part of you that loves you. You know? But we've confused everything.
Well, there's a deal. I don't know if Kim comes so close.
All right, we're going to put curtains up next week. So,
sorry, what's going on?
We're putting curtains up next week. Focus.
I think the hardest problem is people identify with their personality.
Yeah, but which is mind, yeah.
Really,
that's right.
And because they identify with their personality, they identify with their strengths and weaknesses and everything else. Mm-hmm. And one's spiritual self is a reflection of God. If you see that part, you're wonderful. You know, you're not a terrible. You're not something that's terrible. You're something that's wonderful if you identify with the spiritual part of yourself.
Yeah, that's it. But it's quite a task to do. But that's what he's introducing. He seriously says, from the very beginning of your spiritual life, this is what you should do. You ought to consider thoroughly what you are. Consider thoroughly means to sit there and really probe at it. Who am I? What is this thing called a human being? What is this thing, this creation that talks and walks and grows old and does and feels responsible? What is it? You know, and question everything, because that's the problem. We've become deluded by not paying attention. How many of you thought about how, or ever consider the process of your thinking? You know, do we sit there and take it apart? How many of us take the idea of a thought and try and figure out, what is a thought? What is it? How does it happen? How is it that I can hear a thought when there's no sound being made? How is it that I can see an image in my mind when there's no image presented, no light being presented?
Yeah, we saw something.
Three deer.
Yeah.
I just scolded them. I told them I'm putting a.
The deers are there.
Yeah.
I told them I'm putting a curtain up next week.
I didn't know. So
I didn't know they were looking at.
Yes, he just got back last night.
I didn't see the deer. Then I would have taken my phone more.
You're going to run outside with the camera. So when you enter upon spiritual life, this is foundational. You know, this is foundational. And I would say, you know, it's a good practice when you start to do... I know nothing about these things. When you sit to do your practice, take a moment, reorient. Okay, I'm the witness. I'm going to watch my mind think. And you turn on that attention to the role of the listener, to the role of the witness in there. Because that's the part of you that will remain when the body-mind goes off. The noise will stop, at least momentarily, I think. I'm projecting, I don't know exactly what happens when you die. But I assume the noise stops because the mind and body are gone, so the senses shut up. And you're left with the silent witness. You're left with that part of you that you're barely aware of, but that you're always talking to constantly. Always, you know.
But if you leave it all behind with the body, how does the soul find out about it if you've left it all behind? The soul wouldn't have any.
Well, there's a subtle body. that contains all of the vector information.
Oh, so you can't get rid of it, huh?
Well, it does drop off at enlightenment. At real enlightenment, it goes. Or you realize it was never yours. There's no identity with it. That breaks. You can still access it. It's still part of the cosmic.
It's in the iCloud, huh?
Yeah, it's in the iCloud. That's
sweet.
It.
Like
yeah,
that.
It's all there. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing that's very exciting to me about spiritual life, about religion, is the fact that it's real. And the fact that the more sensitive you become, the more aware you become, the more pure you are in mind and heart, the more obvious it is to you. You know, the more you see these things. And you start coming to the point where you realize that it's all inside of you. You know, and things like when the sages do these incredible things that we read about in their stories, we realize that when you are present, when you have calmed your mind, that's the nature of things, because that listener is God. That listener is your divinity, that image, that your reality, your existence.
People have several types of senses. And normally people are only aware of the physical senses and the psychological senses. When you're in the body, people primarily perceive through the physical organs. And then people perceive their thoughts, feelings, and dreams, and so forth, the psychological. If people practice spiritual practice, there's a couple other type of senses that come out. When people die, they lose their physical senses, but then they become more aware because the psychic senses become predominant. If people meditate, sometimes that comes out. Then there's the spiritual senses. And the physical senses is like perceiving with your body. Your mind is perceiving your mind. The psychic senses is like perceiving with your mind. And spiritual experiences is like perceiving with your soul. And people talk about seeing and hearing, but it's sort of a misnomer, I guess.
Yeah, because there's no noise. I mean, if you were actually hearing your thoughts, I'd be like, Maya, can you think a little lower, please? can you turn off the volume on your mind for a minute?
Yeah. People who have had near-death experiences where they left the body, suddenly they are aware of all kinds of things, and they come back and they don't know how they were.
Well, that's the thing. That's what we're talking about, is that when you lose the distractions of all the noise of body-mind, you are instantly aware of your nature, if you've purified, if you've got that notion. You know, if you don't, all you do is run after that noise again. You know, you take refuge in the noise again, and so you take on another body-mind. That's at least in theory, you know, that idea.
Well, that's the problem, is people die. And you would think people would want to be happy in heaven, but no, they have desires, they want to come back to the world again.
Well, yeah, if you believe that you're a body-mind and suddenly you don't have a body-mind, first thing you do is get a body-mind, you know? It's like, that's what you want. Oh my God, where am I? You know, just like you can see that illustrated when Vivekananda had that enlightenment experience at the Kasipur Garden House. He could come back far enough to know his head, but he was like, where's my body? Where's my body? Where is my body? You see? So that's the nature of it. If you're attached to body-mind, you're going to hold on to a body-mind. And when this one goes away, you're going to grab the nearest one. Maybe. You know, these things are all
but also,
positive.
Somebody had asked Swami Vivekananda once that a question was posed, if you can explain Maya. So he told that person, you can ask me any other question but this.
Yeah.
So nobody can understand. It's very difficult. What we are trying to understand is actually something like, you know, it's intangible. And like you said, purified mind. How many of us have it at that level, you know?
No, it's there for all of us. The mind, or the purity is part of us. The impurity belongs to mind. So we have a notion of it. We have a sense of it. You know, but Maya is the story that maintains your ego. It's the story that maintains your ego. So not that Vivekananda couldn't explain it and I can. This is just just making that clear. But this is one way of perceiving it, is sort of how I understood it. It's the story, and it's different for each one of us. Maya is individual. It belongs to each one of us. And it's the story that we tell ourselves to maintain our ego, to maintain our existence, to maintain our sense of agency, to maintain our sense of responsibility. It's the pocket we carry our karma in. And it's the karma itself is our maya, you know, our collection of things. So he says, so when we're starting, we're entering spiritual life, or just as we go in spiritual life, we ought to consider thoroughly what we are, probing to the very depth. So it's important. Probe, because that's who you're trying to find. You're trying to find out, who am I? What am I? What is this? What's going on here? This does not make sense. God, it does not make sense. The more you think about it, the more you probe. And it becomes very uncomfortable. Because like I said, I'm afraid of becoming unhinged, because you start losing those little tiny platforms that you stand on to do the rest of your thinking, to do the rest of your planning and hoping and dreaming and hurting and loving and hating and caring, you know. We shall find that we are altogether deserving of contempt. Ooh, there's an interesting statement. Somebody want to jump on that one? Remember, because we're talking in the Christian tradition, they talk about the self as the fallen self. So when they say something like, we are altogether deserving of contempt, they're identifying with the lower S, the lower self, the self as it exists in its delusion. So they start from that point, and that's why they talk in that kind of language. And it's true from that point, from that perspective. As an ego self, there is no hope for you. The ego cannot give you truth. Truth undoes the ego. You know, truth removes the ego. And so as long as you maintain this attachment and belief in your set of limitations and restrictions, your personality, your thoughts, your body, you are worthy only of contempt. Because, why? Because it's your need to be separate and apart from God which gives birth to that ego. And to believe yourself to be separate and apart from that which gives you your existence, gives you your intelligence, gives you your love and bliss, is an unhopeful state. It's a hopeless state. There nothing will come of that but death. You know, nothing will come of that but dissolution. So that's why he would say it. We would find that we are altogether deserving of contempt, unworthy of the name of Christ. Why? Because we're rejecting Christ to maintain an identity. If we accepted Christ, you know, and when I say Christ, I say the Christ of the Vedantist, which is the Christ that has come as Buddha, and the Christ that has come as Jesus, and the Christ that has come as Ramakrishna, and Rama, and Krishna, and maybe Chaitanya, and maybe Muhammad, who knows? Mm-hmm. But that Christ, we're unworthy of that name. Why? Because to maintain our ego, we have to reject it at a fundamental level. Because in reality, we're one. We're one with the Christ. We're one with God. In the Garden of Eden before the fall, there was one will. It wasn't even a will. There was just one existence, and everybody was in perfect harmony, perfect bliss. When Eve stepped into her senses and looked at the fruit of the tree and saw that it was pleasing to the eye, that it would look like it would be good for food, and then she took it and ate it, that was the whole process of deciding to be separate and apart from God, deciding that you know better, you know, that your desires, your senses, really what she was doing was she stepped into the senses and followed them. If you step into the senses and follow them, this is what happens, your delusion. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we live in that state where we make our decisions based on body-mind, which, think how many times you do that. When you get up in the morning, oh, what do I want to do today? Who are you asking? You're asking a body. You're asking a mind. So who are you serving? A body and a mind. So these are very clear ways that you can become aware of your delusion and how it affects you and how these things are true. So when you get up in the morning, it's not a matter of deciding what I'm going to do today. It's a matter of deciding I'm going to be open to this present moment and express my nature, which is love, which is intelligence, which is existence. And my day will be one big opportunity for service. My day will be one big opportunity of awareness, one big opportunity of loving, you know, expressing what I am.
I I like to think of things in different ways.
Okay.
Different religions sort of express things in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
In Islam, the problem is people forget God, so people pray a lot and try to remember God.
Yes, yes.
In Buddhism, the problem is we're attached to things that are impermanent, so meditate on the nature, on the desires, and let go of one's desires.
Mm-hmm.
Hinduism talks about people are ignorant, you know, so you have to overcome your ignorance. The idea that I'm terrible, the thing is I had a hint of what I am, and what I am is either a part of God or a projection of God. And that's something that's wonderful, so I have a hard time with this idea, I'm a terrible person type of thing.
Yeah, no, I do too. That's why I say for us as Vedantins, we don't really take that position. We emphasize the fact that we are the image of God. And we're constantly trying to refresh that, renew that, become that, take the dust off the lens, as it were.
Yeah, we forget that.
Yeah. And so, because even though the what you just described from all those three different languages, you're describing the exact same condition in three different ways.
Yeah.
So the condition's the same, whether you call it ignorance, whether you call it forgetting God, which is ignorance, or whether you call it attachment, which is the result of forgetting God, you know. So they have one fundamental sameness underlying all of them, our forgetfulness of God. We forget what we are. We forget our nature. And we believe ourselves to be temporal and small, limited and restricted by our attributes that we pile on ourselves.
So when terrible things happen to your body, people get excited.
Really? You better not.
I mean, you get cancer and all the world's coming to an end.
Oh, yeah, in that way. I thought of people jumping up and down, something terrible happens to my body. I was like, you better not. So we're unworthy of our nature if we insist on being separate from it. If we're not acted upon by our nature, which is our love, intelligence, and existence, if that's not our spontaneously manifesting self, then we're unworthy of our nature. You know, we've chosen something lesser.
And it's completely limiting.
Completely encaging.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can't, you know, this is that one thing. I have one big thing in my life that I hold on to, and that was my experience with Moksha Prana. Because in that experience, when she gave me that two-word freedom, it's okay, that is the only time that something direct has ever happened to me. You know, everything else in my life has happened through my body, through my senses.
Yeah.
And I was never aware of how clunky that is, and how hard that is, and how alienating that is, until I had my one singular experience where I received something directly without my body and mind, something that didn't come in through the senses. And that put such a clarity and such a lasting feeling of freedom. Like, I couldn't believe how real that was. I couldn't believe how real, how imminent that was, it was unbelievable. There's no really way to talk about it because it didn't involve the senses and the mind. And that's what's waiting for us. That's what's available to us. But we have to go inside, right?
When you said she gave you the two words, it's okay.
Uh-huh.
Did she actually say it? Or it was...
Because you heard
part
it.
Of that experience?
In the vision, she said it.
Yeah.
But when she said it, they were not words.
Yeah, she didn't say it as a person to you.
Not physically, not in the room. I wasn't in the room. I don't know where I was.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want this out on tape today or not. But anyway, what it was is that it was imminent. It was such isness. She said the words, but the words didn't come to me as words. They came fully with all of what was in her when she said the words. The meaning and the words came together at the same time. I did not have to take the words, it's okay, and put them in my mind and then project all the stuff of what I think it's means onto it, and all the stuff of okay, what I think that means, and then come to my own understanding. It wasn't like that.
Yeah.
The words and the understanding came simultaneously and completely. And it was unbelievable. It was just, it's why I'm here. It's why I've been here for 20 years.
Well, sometimes spiritual experiences sort of touch people
always
in their soul.
Yes.
And it deeply satisfies.
That's it.
Then your feelings and your thoughts try to comprehend it, and you try to put it into feelings and words, but the experience itself is sort of direct.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're changed forever by it. From Krishna Vivekananda, Holy Mother, Swami Prabhudhananda.
You'll get it.
We have to go down the chain there. Swami Prabhudhananda, he said, that's how you know whether a spiritual experience is real or not, whether it's just a fancy or a dream or an imagination. He said, if it's just a fancy or a dream or an imagination, its effect will come and go. You'll remember it for a while, you'll be whatever, but that'll be that. He says, a real spiritual experience leaves you forever changed. It's like seeing that picture, you know, that picture where you look at it and you look at it from, if you take this as the backspace, you see two faces. If you take the white as the backspace, you see a candlestick holder. You know those paintings, so those pictures?
Yeah.
But once you've seen both of them, you can never go back to not seeing them, right? Every time you see it, like, oh, that's that. That's realization, or not realization, that's a spiritual experience. Once you've had a real spiritual experience, you can never return to your ignorance fully.
Mm.
You can't ever return to your ignorant perspective. You know.
I think when people have had a certain amount of spiritual experience, it will always pull them, regardless if they temporarily fall or something like
that. Yes, absolutely. Well, not even just the spiritual experience. You just even coming and asking this question. Thakur says, you know, if you've come to him, you've been bitten by a cobra. At the time is your ignorance is on the clock, baby. It's on its way out. It's just a matter of time. And so you can know that, and we should know that. You know, we should get a lot of joy from that. Thakur very clearly says, and Mother has backed him up, if you've come to this place, it is your last birth. He says that. Don't be afraid to believe it. Actually hold on to it and find a great deal of joy in it, a great deal of faith in that knowing. You know, it will allow you a lot of intimacy with God that your mind will not allow. And that's what faith does. That's what faith does. It undoes the limitations of God's love for you from the mind.
The mind keeps it up away, tries to keep it, shove it off.
Yes, yeah, because the mind and the ego are in cahorts. Cahoots. They're in cahoots.
Cahoots.
Yeah, they're in cahoots. Because the ego, who you think you are, can't exist in the presence of God. That's why God says, if anybody sees me, surely they will die. You know, in the sense that you will be dissolved. And not because you'll be burned like from acid or something. It's because you will let go of everything that you've held on to for this magnificence that is being presented to you. You'll jump in. You'll jump in and with such an enthusiasm and such a longing and such a relief and such a happiness, you know, you'll jump in. So we shall find that we are altogether deserving of contempt, unworthy of the name of Christ, prone to all manner of maladies. See, that's where the prone to maladies comes from. Your weaknesses. If you live in the body and mind, that you're always having to prop up the idea of self. Because your idea of self is wrong. It doesn't have a reality. And so it's always needy. It's always hungry. It's always insecure. You have to come back. You know, when we enter upon spiritual life, we ought to consider thoroughly what we are. That's the only place that hunger is sated. That's the only place that thirst is quenched. It is to live in the space of the listener, the hearer, that's watching all of this hilarity. Become aware of that part of you, not so much the noise part of you, the part of you that's talking to yourself all the time. Become aware of the nature of the listener within you. Emphasize that. It's crazy what it's going to do to you. Because otherwise, we become prone to all manner of maladies and subject to countless infirmities, countless wrong decisions. Countless wrong decisions. When you base your decisions on your body and mind and their needs and their wants, their desires, every time you will make a wrong decision. And it can be simple. It doesn't have to be the big things. Eat that piece of pizza. Mm-hmm. I had such a big victory this week. My friend Jamie took me out for pizza because he had a family problem he wanted to discuss and get my advice on family problems. All right, so he did. So we went to. All right, here we go. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, it's no more foolish than you guys coming here for this class, though. But yeah, this
yeah,
of course.
Insulted?
No, yes. But I mean, insult. I was the reason. I was the cause for the insult, though.
We have no ego anymore. You can call us whatever, right? We don't live on body level anymore.
Yes, we know. We know. We know. That's what. That's the whole
he
thing.
He was testing us, and we all passed.
Yeah, so I was going to boast in my victory. Wait, you've interrupted my boasting.
Yeah.
What is this?
You're talking about pizza.
Yeah, so I was invited. So he invited me out. We went up to this Italian pizza. But guess what I had for dinner?
Salad.
I had a salad.
See,
at a pizza restaurant. Woo! Was I happy. I was so impressed.
Wow.
I was so impressed with myself. But see, that's I joke, but not really joke. That's how we make wrong decisions, right? If we base it on the body, because what did I want? I wanted pepperoni pizza, especially at that place, because they make it real greasy. It's got that red drippy grease on it and all that cheese. Oh, la, 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 la. You know? So if I listened to my body, if I listened to my mind, I would have been munching on pizza. Was it a good decision? No. Because I have a heart and veins in there that are like, we can't deal with that right now, you know? But see, this is how our awareness comes into being. This is how we know. By obeying this first part here, where we ought to consider thoroughly what we are and probing to the very depth, that's how we chisel ourselves free from all forms of malady and all sorts of infirmities and wrong thinking. That's how we do it. We don't have to go attack each thought and educate ourselves in each thought. That's like trying to put out a forest fire with a candle. It can't be done, you know? You have to go to the heart of the matter. Realize who and what you are, and everything will undo itself accordingly. If you know that you're spirit, then you can just look at the mind and be like, are you kidding me? Shut up.
That's what I tell mine all
you
the
know?
Time.
Are you kidding me? You'll hear yourself ask for those ridiculous things. Another piece of cake today? You've had four. Are you kidding me? So he says, so if we do live in that space, he says we're prone to all forms of malady. Prone means you're leaning toward them. You know, you need them. Your weight's leaning on them. You're prone to them. You're subject to countless infirmities. There's going to be one right after the other continuously, which distress us. Hello, right? Doesn't it distresses you? I mean, I went to the doctor, I'd get my numbers, and I'd see my triglycerides at 507. I was distressed. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do with that? You know, cholesterol at 272. I was like, what am I going to do? Oh my God, I'm distressed. You know, when I'm, all my selfishness, my depressions, all these things that happen in the mind, they distress you. So why do you want them? Why do we hold on to this thing, this delusion, and suffer such distress? Where if we sat and probed our nature and pushed it to the very depth, we would be free from it. We would be free from it. It distresses us and impairs the soul's health. Okay, maybe.
That is a question.
It's from a Christian perspective, where the soul is separate from God always. So there's a, they don't have that. Well, they do have it within their saints. The saints have the idea of oneness. But the doctrine does not. So because of that, the soul can be affected by things. And Vedanta, the soul is the unchanging self. It can't be affected.
Yeah.
Just like the air can hold a smell, but it's not the smell. They take the soul to be the embodied Atman. And they don't see it as having a oneness with God as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your soul is eternally separate. That's dualistic.
Yeah.
You know, it's dualistic.
Just like dualistic Indian philosophy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Vedanta, when practiced, is dualistic also. You can't practice Advaita.
No.
There is no practice for Advaita. Yeah. So all practice is dualistic. Yeah.
I think that stage is necessary.
What do you mean by that? Because if you're constantly aware of your the unlimited nature that you have, that is practicing Advaita, right? If you're constantly aware and you make your mind yearn for that and practice that as much as possible, then you're purifying your mind.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, if you would write that down and then go through and circle the number of times you said have, my, you know, all of this ownership, that's all duality.
Yes.
So if you perceive yourself as having a mind, you're in a dual state.
You're saying that there is no practice.
There is no Advaitic practice.
Where the mind actually, there is no action and there is no other.
That's right.
No, because Advaita means you finally become
Advaita,
union with God. So
yeah,
where
exactly.
Would they be?
Exactly. And it's important to know because, of course, not all of us, Westerners in particular, love Advaita because it gets rid of God, that pesky idea of God. I was like, ah. But that's the first thing when you study Advaita that you need to know immediately. One, Advaita is not a practice. It's not a belief system. It's a realization.
Yes.
It's the cherry that you're going to get for the top of your ice cream at the end. And that there is no Advaitic practice. There is none such thing as Advaitic practice.
It's a position.
I don't know what you mean by that, Swami, because if I don't think diversity is eliminated. It's just that you're conscious of your inner nature.
Okay. I'm not going to step on that, but that's not the teaching. Diversity disappears. We have one without a second in the final realization. In one
they
without a second.
In this world,
like
they do
what's
everything
that sounds like samadhi.
For them, you and I are the same God.
Which is not separate from the reality. It's being one with the reality.
But if you are not in a state of samadhi, for example.
Then you're not in an Advaitic space. You're in a dual space.
It can't come and go.
It sure can.
So when they come down from samadhi,
uh-huh.
They know that for existing in this world that you and I are separate, but this you, everything is one consciousness. Because remember when Vivekananda had this, he says for 3-4 days it was hard for him to do anything.
Yeah.
He couldn't walk, he couldn't step on anything. It was like he could not get over it that everything is one.
Yeah, but even at that state there was an awareness of an I that was separate. Because an I that's not separate wouldn't step on something.
Yeah,
so, and it's not that diversity doesn't exist. Diversity does not exist. That's the thing. What exists is your ignorance that gives birth to diversity. What we're seeing is God and God alone. You know, and it's the level of consciousness from which it's perceived that lets you know the truth of the matter. If you are in your true state of knowledge, there's one without a second. We can't say anything about it because you can't talk in that state. You're one without a second. There's no subject-object. There's no relationship. All right? Diversity in actuality is part of ignorance.
Actually, what does it say? Then Maya also disappears. Everything is one consciousness.
Yes.
You are only good, good, and good. There's nothing bad about anybody then.
Well, there is no anybody.
Everybody, because it's all one consciousness.
Yes, there isn't anybody.
You said, Swamiji, it's okay when you had that spiritual thing, whatever. So what was that? That's not...
It's not realization.
No, it's not realization. Then what stage is that?
Toddler.
Sorry?
At least you are as a toddler there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we
I mean it's a toddler, but you're here without it, so you're very fortunate. Sick people get the medicine. that's how it is. So okay, so are we kind of clear on that? Does that make sense to you? No,
not
at all.
Not yet, because if there is no Advaitic practice, what are we even saying?
Practice requires duality. You can't practice without other.
But
So
yes.
all practices are dual in nature. And we practice it in order to reach an advaitic understanding, or an which is not true at all, but the only way we can say it. We're practicing to come to our knowledge, our realization of what is. And when we get there, we realize that anything that would cause the idea of other is gone, is not there. There is no other. So it's like a dream at night, okay? When you have a dream, there's other. There's all kinds of people. I had another ghost dream last night. But anyway, there's other, okay? So in the dream, yes, all of it's there. When you wake up in the morning, you don't look around for all the people in your dream. You don't go searching through your closet, where is that monster that was getting me last night, right? Because you know they're not there. They didn't exist. But you can talk about the dream. You know, you can talk about the dream. So in that sense, their samskara remains. The samskara of the dream remains. But the dream itself had no reality, had no existence. It was never there. It was a fantasy of ignorance.
Yeah, but...
So this world is a fantasy of ignorance. And it does, in fact... It's not that it disappears. What happens is you see it for what it is, which is yourself. So you can no longer see the multiplicity, the diversity.
So, okay, what use is Advaita if there is no... I thought that we strive. I'm not striving to go into samadhi, or you're just striving. There is no limit to... Positive. There's no limit to the growth that you can have as a person of love, and the more, and striving towards that, and just continuously getting better at it, or not at it, but I don't know what words to use for that, but that striving itself is practice, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not Advaitic practice. Advaita is the ultimate truth. The practice is dual because you are practicing something. There's an I and a you and a we and all of that.
Okay.
So no practices are Advaitic. There are practices that lead to Advaita, to the understanding, but no practice is Advaitic.
Yeah.
All practice requires duality. You know, all practice requires duality. So there's not, if you're going to be an Advaitist, I guess the purest Advaitic practice would be Jnana Yoga. You know, where you sit there asking, who am I? Good God, what is this thing? You know, so you could call that an Advaitic practice, but there's nothing about that practice that is Advaitic.
But people like Ramana Maharishi,
yeah,
I was supposed to have gotten that illumination.
Uh-huh.
But he went into the cave and he was in total meditation, not even aware of his body being eaten.
Yes.
So without that kind of a practice, there's no sense in saying that we are even trying to be Advaitic practice, because even for ordinary people that's not even possible, right?
Well, it's
kind of a...
Of course it's possible. Of course it's the goal of life.
Yeah, but not everybody reaches that point.
And well,
before doing a lot of other things.
Yes. No argument with any of that. But there's a couple of things to understand. As soon as Ramana Maharshi had his enlightenment, Ramana Maharshi, as such, no longer existed from any perspective but our own.
Mm-hmm.
We see that body, we hear that mind, and we call it Ramana Maharshi.
Mm-hmm.
He is not there. He, as an I, does not inhabit that body anymore.
But his soul is in the body, right?
No, not at that level.
Soul is gone.
No, the soul is everywhere.
All pervading.
The soul is all pervading. He's not localized anymore. He doesn't have an idea of I, of a small self, anymore. Ramana Maharshi, at that point of enlightenment, is universal.
But
you know, just like Ramakrishna. When Ramakrishna had that enlightenment experience, from that point on, in actuality, there was no longer a Ramakrishna.
But he still went and did all the practices of the previous...
The body was there, doing what the body did, as its karma and its samskaras dictated. Yes, but he was no longer there. He was everyone in the room. He had to tie ignorance together and hold on to it in order to occupy that space.
But the reason he did all that is to teach the disciples.
There's not reasons at that level. Yeah, there's not reasons at that level. At that level, it's a spontaneous manifestation of the divine. Everything that happened, happened. You can't, unless you know God, you can't say why or attach a reason. But see, the problem is that everything we know about all of our saints and avatars and incarnations is written down by us who are still in ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So we describe them in ways that keep Ramakrishna intact all the way until he died of cancer. You know, because we project onto him what we think he is based on what we know of, or what we think we know of who we are. Which is why we see individuals everywhere. There's a big hint that that Sri Nisargadatta gives. He says, when we talk about ourself, when we envision ourself, we think from the outside in. A knower sees from the inside out. So when you think of yourself, when you describe yourself, even when you consider yourself, if you pay attention to how you do it, you will see that you actually step